I'm Chuck Kuhnert, and this is Fire in the Forest, The Death of Smokey the Bear. And it's one of a continuing series that we're running this two-week session on our involvement with the environment. To begin with, I'd like to read a quote from the Forest Service Policy Manual called Forest Protection Board Number 6 Manual. The date is 1929. All forests under federal ownership or jurisdiction should be protected from destruction by fire. As to the ownership of property, the federal government is morally, if not legally, charged with the duty to prevent a nuisance. The policy introduced in that manual in 1929 was subsequently reinforced by two particular public images. The first was a character named Smokey the Bear, and all of you are familiar with Smokey, and if you're not, I'll call your attention to the posters drawn up on the wall next to the children's library by the original painter of Smokey the Bear, the original creator of Smokey the Bear, who sent these to Holden Village after he visited Holden. He painted a couple of paintings specifically for Holden up there. And so you might want to take a moment sometime to just pass by and look at those. One of them shows Smokey the Bear in Holden Village, so it's kind of interesting. If you come up the hill from Chelan, you'll notice the first sign to greet you on the way up is a Smokey the Bear sign. It says, "Please prevent forest fires." And largely, Smokey the Bear was a media program developed by the U.S. Forest Service, obviously to prevent forest fires. But a second public image that had a profound impact on the mind of Americans was a movie that Walt Disney put out called Bambi. It impacted people in a couple of ways, but particularly with respect to fires, the image of the forest fire killing off Bambi's parents or mother was hard for most red-blooded Americans to take, and it added, paradoxically, fuel to the fire to prevent forest fires. Somewhat also paradoxical that we're meeting in the fireside room. In 1960, ecologists for the first time began to take the position that fire was an important part of maintaining most ecosystems. This paper, entitled The Ecology of Fire, appeared in Scientific American in April of 1961. In this paper, a number of points are made about fire, and it was at this time, the late 50s and early 60s, that much evidence began to accumulate that pointed to the concept that fire had to be allowed to occur if we were in fact to maintain a natural condition in our ecosystems. For example, the Great Plains of America, the grasslands of Nebraska and Iowa, Kansas and eastern Colorado, did not originate primarily because of a lack of moisture, but rather they originated and were maintained because of periodic fires which killed off deciduous trees. And in those areas of those states where fires are prevented and where fields are allowed to grow, for example on abandoned farm lots, forests are now growing once again. Whereas when the settlers originally came across in the wagon trains, there were no forests there. It was all grassland. grasslands are maintained by fire. You must have fire to continue to maintain grasslands. And much more immediate concern to the residents of Holden is the fact that alpine meadows are also maintained by fire. So those of you who hike into Copper Basin and hike up to Holden Lake to view the meadows that are so resplendent in wildflowers at this time should be aware that those meadows will cease to exist if fire is not allowed to occur in those areas. On the other hand, of course, there is some concern by residents of Holden that fires not be allowed to consume the village, obviously. So we have this dilemma. It's sort of the extremes that Bill Miller was talking about in his session earlier this morning. On the one hand, we have the extreme of allowing nature to run its course and allowing fires to burn completely, allowing what happens happen, and thereby attempting to maintain a totally natural ecosystem. On the other hand, we have the extreme of Smokey the Bear, of Bambi, of the typical American mentality, which says stop all fires immediately. Somewhere in between, I believe, we need to come to an understanding of what needs to happen. And I don't believe that there are very simple answers to it, but there may be different answers under different circumstances. And that's what we intend to discuss today a little bit. Today we're going to focus on one particular interesting issue, which was the burning of Yellowstone Park in 1988. And that will be the source of the majority of information that we're going to share with you today. And we're going to use that as a case study for what the prevention of forest fires might be doing and what allowing forest fires to burn might be doing. Let me point out a couple of other pertinent facts with respect to forest fires, particularly in this area, that may be helpful as we think about this. This area is not identical to Yellowstone, and each ecosystem has its own particular set of requirements with respect to fire. Douglas fir trees, however, are the dominant species in this ecosystem. And quite frankly, there are only two ways to allow Douglas fir trees to continue to exist in an area. You either allow fires to burn out the area, which then allows the seedlings of the Douglas fir to sprout and grow, because Douglas fir seedlings, unlike spruce seedlings or hemlock seedlings, require full sunlight. If they are shaded by other trees, they do not grow well at all and cannot compete. So you either allow the fire to go through and destroy the area, burn off the canopy, and allow the sunlight to go to the ground, thus allowing the seedlings to spring up, or you clear cut it. Those are the only two ways you can grow Douglas fir seedlings successfully. You cannot selectively log and grow Douglas fir at the same time. It does not work. So that's something to keep in mind. This is a Douglas fir forest that we're in right now. A second point that you need to know is that some types of plants, particularly the alder and lodgepole pine, are positively influenced by fire in the sense that alder, the tree that we find when we hike up toward Heart Lake in great abundance, and there's some of them down here along the riverbank, they have the quaking leaves, not alder, excuse me, I'm talking about aspen, the quaking aspen leaves, the beautiful tree that turns just this brilliant gold color in the fall, which makes this valley particularly remarkably beautiful. And if you've been in the Colorado Rockies in the fall, you know the same thing, because that's the center of the aspen. Those trees require fire to spread. They do not seed themselves very well at all, but rather they grow by suckers that come out from the roots of the tree and spread that way. And those suckers do not grow until the main stem of the tree dies. And the quickest way to have that spread occur is by burning off the forest of the aspen. So the forest maintains aspen. Fires in the forest maintain aspen. In the case of lodgepole pine, their cones are a type that we call serotinous. Serotinous cones are cones that are sealed shut with rosin. And the only way those cones open is with the heat of a fire. The heat melts the rosin, the pitch, unglues the bracts of the cone, and exposes the seeds, which then fall on the ground, and they germinate quite well in the burned over soil. So those are the conditions that are necessary for lodgepole pine to germinate. So different species have different requirements. Grasses, similarly, are killed only at the surface when a fire goes by. Their roots are generally untouched by most forest fires, and so grasses are not negatively harmed. In fact, what occurs after a forest fire is quite frequently many types of annual plants and grasses grow much more luxuriantly because the nutrients from the burned material have been returned to the soil very rapidly. In Oregon, the Willamette Valley is known for its grass seed. Farmers, it's where almost all the grass grown in the United States is grown. It's grown in the Willamette Valley. And farmers for years burned the grasses, the grass fields in August and September for two reasons. One was to keep weeds under control because many weeds are not fire tolerant. But number two was to return the nutrients of the grass to the soil very rapidly, and it saves them money in fertilizing the soil that way. In fact, my first year in Portland, we went on faculty retreat at an abbey called Mount Angel, which is south of Portland, about 40 miles. And the abbey sits on the top of a mountain that overlooks the Willamette Valley. And it was remarkable to look out over the valley and see what seemed to be the entire valley ablaze at night. You could just see the fires glowing all over the valley. Really remarkable. The smoke from that got so upsetting to people in Oregon, those of you who live down there know that, grass fire burning is strictly regulated, and there's very little of it done now compared to the old days. But each type of organism, each type of ecosystem has its own requirements with respect to fire. Now I'm going to ask you for a moment to consider the circumstances in which we find ourselves right now in Holden Village. It does not take a genius to figure out that this is very hot weather. I saw the thermometer as I walked in here. In the shade, it was 91 degrees, which means that in the sun, we're probably talking about 105 or as much as 110 degrees. The humidity is relatively low, I would guess 20 to 25% right now. We have a measurable wind. People who were doing wash yesterday told me that if they were hanging wash out on the line, before they made it all the way around the clothes, the first clothes they put up were just about dry. It's that dry up here right now. In the summer of 1988, my wife and I and our family began our biannual pilgrimage to the Holy Land of Michigan, where our families reside, to do our penance for moving to the West Coast and visiting parents and relatives back there, which we have to do every 2 years. And we decided to do something really nice, and that is camp our way back. So the first night we camped in Idaho Falls, Idaho, which is right on the border going over into the Tetons. That night, as we drove across that day, as we drove across Idaho, it was about 105 degrees. In Boise, it was 105, and I don't know what it was the other ways across, but it was hot. Car boiled over a couple times, had to stop, get the radiator fixed, do all that stuff. We got into Idaho Falls about 10 at night, And all along the range of mountains, which borders the backside of Idaho Falls, you could see the storm clouds and lightning strikes hitting. Very little rain, but lightning strikes. Well, that night we put up our tent in the rain, and lightning struck, but the rain was minimal. It was just a lot more thunder and lightning than it was rain. The next day we drove over to the Tetons. The temperature was about 102. As we drove up from Jackson Hole, and when we got into Yellowstone the following day, the temperature was above 100 degrees the entire time. Now understand that where we were in Yellowstone is 8,000 feet elevation. We're at 3,200. That's another 4,000 feet above where we were, where we are right now. And it was 100 and some degrees. The humidity got down to 12%. The winds were about 40 miles an hour. Now that was in the end of June. Surprisingly, April and May had been extremely moist months. They had a late spring, lots of rain, and no one anticipated what was going to happen. The drought that began in June continued throughout the rest of the summer and into October. No significant rain fell until October. It was the hottest summer ever recorded in the history of Yellowstone Park in 117 years of keeping records. And the moisture content of the wood, the dead wood, dropped from its normal 15% to, in most cases, under 7%. And to give you a frame of reference, kiln-dried lumber that comes out of the kiln, has a moisture content of 12%. So this is drier than kiln-dried lumber by a long shot, less than one-half the moisture content in most of that. So anyway, with that background in mind, let's also keep in mind a Forest Service policy change which occurred in 1976. I read you a Forest Service policy of 1929. The 1960 ecological studies indicated to the Forest Service that they needed to reevaluate their policy. In 1976, they adopted a policy which essentially stated that all naturally caused fires, that is, essentially all fires caused by lightning strikes, would be allowed to burn, provided they did not threaten lives or property. That policy was in effect in the summer of 1988 as the fires broke out in Yellowstone. And so it was with that policy in mind. And by the way, that policy was adopted at the urging of environmentalist groups. It was with that policy in mind that the fires initially were not fought. But as we'll see a little later in the slideshow, that decision was rescinded as early as the middle of July. And after that point, every fire, no matter what its origin, was fought. But the fires were so furious that the ability of the humans to fight them was minimal. The impact of firefighting was almost negligible in Yellowstone. The only thing that it really managed to do was save Old Faithful Lodge and the surrounding buildings. That was the one thing that they think the firefighting really accomplished. But in terms of otherwise saving the forest, it really had very little effect. Now, before we begin the slideshow, I want to go through some options and some thinking that I want you to play with as we see the film. And at the end, we'll perhaps have a couple of minutes to look at your feelings about forest fires and how you'd like to see them worked with. There really are many options in terms of fire suppression. And I've listed five sort of contrasting ones that are very simplistic, just to give you an idea of what we're talking about. There's the extreme of fighting all fires totally. If they spot a fire, you send troops in, you send helicopters in, you dump loads of retardant on it, you dump water on it, you do whatever, you take bulldozers in if you can get them there, and you plow fire lines around it, and you control it immediately, as quickly as you can. The opposite end of the spectrum is really proposed by some people, which is to let all fires burn. To let all fires burn, no matter what. No matter if they threaten lives, or threaten houses, or threaten cities, or whatever, you let them burn. Now that's obviously an extreme position. In between, we have some ranges. One would be that you fight all fires that threaten commercial, timber that has commercial value, that fight all fires that threaten property and any fires that threaten lives. A less extreme position would be to not worry about the commercial value of the timber, but anything that threatens buildings and lives, then you'd fight it. Yeah.
Does burned timber have much commercial value?
Depends on how hot the fire is and what type of timber it is. Most of the timber after a fire is salvageable, and they can pull it out. It's not anywhere near as valuable as it was beforehand, but you can usually chip off the burned layer and still use it for peeler cores, peelers to make plywood or pulp or even structural lumber. If it's really hot, it will sometimes cause the wood itself to crack all the way through the tree. In fact, sometimes even causing the grain to twist, which means that the tree is worthless as far as structural lumber is concerned and peeler. Another option would be only to fight it if it threatens lives. So that's kind of the range. But then when you take those five options, there are other parameters that need to be looked at. For example, it was the Forest Service policy to fight all man-caused fires, no matter what. If they could determine that it was camper's carelessness or somebody smoking a cigarette that caused the fire, or an electrical line dropped down and caused the fire, they fought it, no matter where it was, or whatever. And only natural causes, and primarily that would be lightning strikes, were allowed to burn in this, what is called a prescribed fire manner. The second consideration might be, is it in wilderness area or non-wilderness area? We're 3/4 of a mile here from the Glacier Peak Wilderness Area. The Forest Service right now has a different policy for fighting fires here as opposed to the fires 3/4 of a mile away. Unfortunately for us, that ain't gonna make a whole lot of difference, because if they allow that fire to burn 3/4 of a mile away,
guess what?
Yeah. The third thing is, this is the actual Forest Service terminology. They have what they call the C+NVC. Okay, and that is a sum of the cost of fighting the fire plus the net value change in the land. And primarily they're talking about commercial value of the timber, although it will also talk about value as a recreational resource for hunting or fishing or hiking or camping or those kinds of things, and include that, although that's a little bit tough to put a dollar figure on. They'll include that when they decide what the total cost to fight plus the net value change is. What they want to do, their goal is to minimize this equation, to minimize the total sum of the cost of fighting plus the net value change. Obviously, if they have a fire that breaks out on the top of Buckskin, up behind us here, the cost for fighting that is going to be considerable, because the only way they're going to get people up there to fight it is drop them in by helicopter or hike in below carrying all the equipment. Very difficult to fight a fire in that kind of terrain. The net value change might be very minimal. We might lose a few trees up there, But that does, that, those trees don't have commercial value anyway. Nobody's going to harvest those trees. They're too far up the mountainside. So in that case, if the fire breaks out up there, they're probably going to let it burn. Because that makes more sense than spending a lot of money fighting. The last thing I want to point out is we need to look at long-term and short-term gains and compare those two. When the Yellowstone fires burned, people in America, by and large, that were acquainted with the fires, saw it on the media, got the impression from the media that this was a devastating Holocaust that had occurred in Yellowstone. And did an interview, I don't know how many people they interviewed, but it was a scientific sampling of people to get their opinions on what should be done about the Forest Service fire policy. And of those who responded to the survey, only 7% thought that the fires in Yellowstone might be beneficial. 93% thought the fires in Yellowstone had either totally destroyed the park or caused such major devastation that it would be years and years before Yellowstone ever recovered. Okay, so those are some of the parameters that we're dealing with when we deal with forest fires. It's a very complex issue. I'm going to take a look now at the slides of the Yellowstone fires, and if you have any questions as we go along, just shout them out. Okay. Switch for that over here. Right here. Get that switch there. The light switch here on the wall. Alright, great. The Yellowstone fires of 88 were one of the most significant ecological events in the history of Yellowstone National Park and the entire National Park Service. They began in June and July. By August, much of the park was in flames. At times, the fire fronts advanced at speeds of up to 2 miles per hour. Daily advances of 5 to 10 miles were common. On August 20th, called Black Saturday, more acres burned, 150,000. In one 24-hour period than during any decade since the park was established in 1872. Unlike most fires which die down after dark, the Yellowstone fires of 88 maintained their fury around the clock. It wasn't until snow fell in mid-September that they were finally brought under control. Some burning continued until November 13th. In the nation as a whole, 1988 was one of the worst fire years since the turn of the century. Approximately 5 million acres burned throughout the West. At least 30,000 firefighters fought 70,000 blazes. The final burn tally for the entire Yellowstone ecosystem was well over 1 million acres. The 8 major fires in Yellowstone National Park itself affected 793,880 of the park's 2.2 million acres. This figure may be misleading because within the fire perimeters, many patches were burned only slightly or not at all. The result was a mosaic of burned, partially burned, and unburned areas. And here you see that kind of mosaic pattern where there's green splotches and the brown splotches are where it burned off. The biggest firefighting effort in history did little to stop the Yellowstone fires of 1988. Over 9,000 men and women from as far away as Hawaii and Florida were employed. Many had worked on previous fires. 4,400 soldiers and Marines were brought in later to relieve the weary firefighters. One of the main tasks was scraping vegetation from strips of ground so that the advancing flames had nothing to burn. Unfortunately, these fire lines were generally ineffective in stopping the fires. Most of the injuries were minor, although one firefighter was killed by a falling snag and another died in a helicopter mishap. State-of-the-art technology, along with more than 100 fire trucks, were used to fight the Yellowstone fires. Flame retardant foam was shot from fire hoses to moisten plants and structures. Over 1.4 million gallons of fire retardant were also released from airplanes, while dozens of helicopters dropped 10 million gallons of water. Conditions were so uniquely ripe for a sustained mass fire that models calculated to predict the course of the blazes proved useless. The cost of fighting the fires in the greater Yellowstone area was $120 million. In most cases, the large animals, for which Yellowstone is so famous, simply moved out of the way of the approaching flames. In the greater Yellowstone area, about 350 elk and 9 bison were killed. These losses were small compared to the total pre-fire herd sizes of roughly 30,000 elk and 2,000 bison. In addition, 36 deer, 12 moose, and 6 black bears perished in and around the park because of the fires. We don't think one was smoky, but you can't tell. No grizzly bears were killed during the fires. The mortality of certain small animals was higher because it was more difficult for them to avoid the flames. Many escaped into their burrows, but others died there of suffocation. Large numbers of predatory birds congregated near the fires as their rodent prey were suddenly left without cover. Most of the wildlife deaths were caused by smoke inhalation. Smoke from the Yellowstone fires was visible as far away as Minnesota. Anybody see it?
Yeah.
Oh, yeah.
See, they're true. This does not lie. And even from outer space. Some people said that breathing the air was like smoking 4 packs of cigarettes per day. The smoke posed health problems for nearby communities. Visitors with respiratory problems were warned to stay away. The smoke also hindered them to fight the fires. Most of the in-park developments, as well as a few surrounding communities, were evacuated at least once during the Yellowstone fires of 1988. A total of 36 private structures and 29 owned by the Park Service were destroyed. An additional 12 structures were damaged. Only luck and good dousings with water and flame retardant foam saved many buildings. This is West Yellowstone, Montana, with the entire area behind it burned. As our oldest and most famous national park, Yellowstone receives over 2 million visitors a year. The chief attractions are the geysers and colorful hot springs. These were unharmed by the fires. The entire park was closed only on September 10th, but certain park roads were often closed. The total attendance drop from May 1st to October 1st, 1988, was 16% over the previous year. However, park attendance during October 1988 was actually much higher than usual, probably because people were curious to see what the fires had done. During 1989, tourism at Yellowstone was back to normal. The media often gave the mistaken impression that everything in the park was destroyed. One researcher found that media reports on the Yellowstone fires revealed an error rate nearly twice that typically found in accuracy studies. In another study, over half the people interviewed felt the damage to the park had been extreme or devastating, while only 7.3% said the fires had been beneficial. Large fires are rare in the high 8,000 foot above sea level lodgepole pine forest covering 80% of Yellowstone. Heavy snow and occasional summer rain keep moisture levels high enough to retard combustion. Also, in Yellowstone's younger lodgepole pine forests, small surface fires are unable to climb into the canopy where they can explode into tree-killing blazes. This is partly because there is little flammable undergrowth and minimal fuel loads during the first century or so of the forest's existence. A second reason that the fires rarely reach the canopy of a young lodgepole forest in Yellowstone is that lodgepole are self-pruning. That is, the lower branches die and drop off as the tree grows taller, making it difficult for fires to ladder up the trunks. With sufficient moisture, a shade-tolerant understory of Engelmann spruce and subalpine fir will eventually develop beneath the lodgepole canopy. If there is no fire for 200 or 300 years, the spruce and fir will grow above the light-craving lodgepole and shade them out. Thus, the spruce fir forest is the climax environment for much of Yellowstone. But sooner or later, lightning usually does ignite a fire. The spruce and fir trees, which are not self-pruning, then provide ladders for the flames to crown out into the lodgepole canopy. At the beginning of the summer of 1988, approximately one-third of Yellowstone's forests were older than 250 years and had thick, flammable understories of spruce and fir. The fact that many of Yellowstone's forests were in a very late stage of succession made mass fire inevitable. All that was needed was a dry, windy summer. The summer of 1988 was one of the driest in the park's 116-year history. Almost no rain fell. This was surprising because April, May, and the previous six summers had been wetter than average. The relative humidity dropped as low as 6%. Plus, temperatures were unusually high. The hot, dry weather lowered the moisture content in dead logs and branches from the usual 15 to 20% to only 7%. When fuel moisture reaches levels of 8 to 12%, lightning fires are very common. The summer of 88 was exceptionally windy in Yellowstone. A series of dry fronts brought regular gusts of 40 to 60 miles an hour. These not only fanned the flames, but also promoted spotting, in which wind-blown embers ignited new flare-ups up to a mile and a half from the main blazes. Thus, the fires easily crossed natural fire barriers such as rivers or canyons, geyser fields, parking lots, and fire lines. The winds also drove different fires together. Forest fires sometimes create their own wind. As hot air from a large fire rises rapidly, oxygen rushes in from the bottom. This causes the flames to grow still larger, sometimes as high as 200 feet. The result is a swirling, noisy inferno called a firestorm. Firestorms are impossible to extinguish by artificial means, and during Yellowstone's 1988 fire season, their advances were virtually unstoppable. In the northern 20% of the Yellowstone National Park, lodgepole forests are less common because the land is lower and drier. The weather there is warmer with little or no snow cover. Drought-resistant sagebrush, grasses, and wildflowers are dominant, with some small stands of aspen and Douglas fir in the moister areas. Fuel accumulations in the North Range are relatively low, so the fires are less intense, and recovery from seeds and underground plant parts is quite rapid. The drier conditions here would allow fires to occur approximately once every 20 to 30 years were it not for suppression by humans. Fire damage to forests, buildings, and wildlife in and around Yellowstone caused many to question the park's natural burn policy, or the let it burn policy, as some mistakenly called it. To understand this policy, we should first look at the history of fires and ecological systems. Lightning has always ignited dry vegetation in many parts of the world. Fossilized fire scars have been found on petrified trees such as these in Yellowstone Park. There is good evidence that certain Indians and early settlers set fires to stimulate the growth of succulent plants preferred by wildlife, as well as to facilitate hunting and travel, and to drive enemies from hiding. One of the quotes that's in the article that I mentioned, written in 1961 about using fires in ecosystems, was a quote from the history of the Massachusetts Bay Colony. It was written during the time of the Massachusetts Bay Colony, dated 1632, and it states, "The savages are accustomed to set fire of the country in all places where they come, and to burn it twice a year, at the spring and at the late fall leaf. The reason that moves them to do so is because it would be otherwise so overgrown with underweeds that it would be all coppice wood, and the people could not be able in any wise to pass through the country out of a beaten path. So Indians have been using fire to make paths for themselves for centuries. In the 19th century, fires were regarded as a danger to civilization and an enemy of the commercial timber industry. When Yellowstone was established in 1872, even lightning caused fires were thought to stand in the way of the park's mandate to preserve nature in a primitive state. During the 20th century, the cartoon Bambi and a campaign by the National Forest Service featuring Smokey the Bear heightened the public's anti-fire attitude. Then during the 60s, scientists began to recognize the lightning-caused fires had value in many ecological systems, including Yellowstone. Fires restore nutrients to the soil, stimulate growth of plants preferred by wildlife, and increase species diversity. Fire also thins the forest and reduces competition for light and nutrients among the surviving trees. Furthermore, recently burned areas act as natural fire breaks because the young plants growing here generally do not support fires.
Chuck, on that particular slide now,
yeah,
what would be your reasonable guess as to the number of years required to restore that particular acreage to where it was before the fire?
Well, those stands appear to be lodgepole pine that are probably 150 years old. They grow slowly in Yellowstone because of the drought conditions in the summertime. And when they get to be 50 to 70 feet tall, that's between 100 and 150 years.
Wow.
So in order to restore that area directly to what you see or what you can imagine it was when it burned is about 150 years.
Thank you.
Based on the history of fire occurrence in Yellowstone, the benefits of fire to the natural ecosystem, and a brief experimental program, the park decided in 1976 to allow lightning-caused fires to burn with close monitoring. These were called prescribed natural fires. Those fires which posed a threat to human life, property, or resources, and any fires which did not begin naturally were designated wildfires and were suppressed as soon as possible. While the natural burn policy was in effect, approximately 80% of all lightning-caused fires fizzled out soon after they were started. That's without man intervening. From 1976 through 1988, an average of 15 lightning-caused fires were monitored and allowed to burn each year. Most of these affected no more than 100 acres, and only 8 burned more than 1,000 of the park's 2 million acres. None were a threat to human life or property. At the beginning of the 1988 fire season, fuel loads, and by fuel loads we're talking about down dead trees, shrubs that have died, dry grasses and things like that. Fuel loads were known to be high, but no one anticipated the severe wind and lack of rain, so the natural burn policy remained in effect. However, contrary to public opinion, the influence of this policy on the extent of the fires in 1988 was limited. Over half the burned acres resulted from fires beginning outside the park by careless humans. These were fought continually from their outset. In addition, after mid-July, all fires were fought, no matter what their source. At that time, mid-July, less than 5% of the final burn area had been affected. According to one firefighting expert, the fires of 88 were so furious that had they done nothing at all, additional land burned would have been no more than 20% of the total. It has been suggested that the massive fuel buildup prior to the summer of 88 resulted from years of fire suppression before the natural burn policy was established. However, effective firefighting methods did not come into existence until after World War II, when aircraft were first employed. Hardly enough time to cause much of a slowdown in the fuel buildup taking place during Yellowstone's normal 300 to 400 year burn cycle. Also, some contend that small artificial burns set by park personnel could have reduced the dangerous fire buildup. Successful artificial burn programs have been carried out in other national parks such as Everglades and Sequoia. But park officials counter that most of Yellowstone is too large and remote for safe and efficient artificial burning. Furthermore, it is not yet known whether many small fires are the ecological equivalent to one large fire. Still, some artificial burning may be done in the future to reduce fuel loads close to civilization. After careful review, the park has decided to continue the natural burn policy with closer attention to weather conditions and potential harm to human life and property. Many feel that fires on the scale of the summer of '88 will not be possible for a very long time now that much of the park's older forests have been eliminated. Most scientists regard the fires of '88 as part of a long natural cycle of events in the Yellowstone ecosystem. In approximately 15% of the park, there was total destruction of the forest canopy. About 13% of the park experienced ground burns in which only some of the trees were killed. Another 2% was composed of meadow and sage burns. The remaining 6% was made up of a variety of burn types. The result was a mosaic of burned, partially burned, and unburned areas. There was a question about salvaging burned timber. Here's a picture of salvaging the burned timber. The Forest Service initially was not going to allow salvage of the burned timber to occur, but after viewing the amount of burned timber that was near roadsides and the amount that might provide fuel for future fires, they decided to allow harvesting of that or salvaging of that timber near the roadways and near public access areas. They did not salvage any of it in the interior. Regrowth of plants began even before the last flames were extinguished. This picture was taken in July of 1989, the following summer. This weed is fireweed, which is characteristic of burned areas. This plant is another one of those unique plants. It has a seed that requires fire to germinate. It pops like popcorn in fire, and that's the only way the seed case opens. So you'll always see fireweed where fires have been the prior year, and it takes over the area very quickly. This is a picture taken again in June of 1989, and this is a bull elk grazing in an area that was burned over. You can see that while the trees are burned and still apparently dead, the grasses are lush, and there's much more food, much more fodder for the elk here than had the fire not occurred. Regrowth occurs everywhere with a few exceptions. This is one of the exceptions. This is called a sterilized soil area. And what happens in this area is that a log falls down on the ground, or there is other wood on the ground, that burns so furiously, so intensely, that the heat from it actually sterilizes all the soil for a distance of anywhere from 6 to 8 inches below the surface of the soil, which is enough to kill all bacteria, all fungi, all seeds, all animals that happen to be living in that strip. Notice that immediately next to it, there's already regrowth of some type of lily, it looks like, sprouting up there. This again, a picture taken in the spring following the fire.
That sterile area, how long will it be before growth will start in there?
It will depend on the way in which the environment reacts or acts in that area. It depends on moisture, how much rainfall there is, the slope of the land, whether you're going to get nutrients coming in from above into that area. If it's on a totally flat area where there's no rainfall that's going to be washing nutrients into the area, the sterile area will exist for years, maybe 30 years. Fortunately, sterile areas are usually confined to rather small sizes. These are those serotonous cones that I was talking about on the lodgepole that have popped open here following the fire. You'll see these on lodgepole pines. We have some lodgepole pines around Holden here. And if you notice, they have actually two types of cones. The serotonous cones are usually closer to the center of the tree, the trunk of the tree, and they're closed. And then the other types of cones that are closer to the tip of the tree, tip of the branches, are open, and they put seeds out on a regular basis. But lodgepole is particularly well suited to coming back from fires because of those serotonous cones. The other cones are destroyed in the fire, and the seeds that they drop on the ground are killed. But those seeds, because they don't open until after the fire has passed, drop on the ground that's just right for their fertilization or for their germination. This picture was taken at the Beaver Creek site in June of 1989. And in this particular case, you see a good example of the type of mosaic that they were talking about, because young lodgepole pines are quite fire resistant in and of themselves. Small seedlings usually do not burn. In the Yellowstone fires, there were some exceptions to that, where stands of young lodgepole actually burned off, and that helped contribute to the jumping to the canopy of the fire. Normally this is the situation where the lodgepole seedlings will survive the fire quite well. Interestingly, the southern pine, for those of you who know anything about lumber, southern pine is competes with Douglas fir for the number one wood in America. Southern pine has a similar situation. Its seedling is a little bush, looks like a porcupine. It has needles that are about 7 or 8 inches long. And the fires that sweep through the area burn off those needles, and what you have left is a little stump, looks like a finger that's been charred, sticking out of the ground. And when that happens, in the next 2 years, the seedling grows 7 feet. Just shoots up. And once it does, it's then immune to fires for a while. And so the southern pine also requires fire for its maintenance. Many of you might want to think about the concept. Bill was asking before how long it would take to refurbish that area that was burned off to the same state as it was. I want you to understand that there may be value judgments that we place on certain types of forests that may or may not be true. In other words, a mature lodgepole pine forest actually is the equivalent of a desert. It's a highly non-productive area. There's very little food for wildlife to graze upon in a mature lodgepole pine forest. And it is actually the fire which returns the nutrient cycle to allow the growth of material which elk and moose and things like that can live on. So just because it's an old growth forest doesn't necessarily mean that Bambi likes it. So we have to be careful when we make value judgments about this. The owl may like it, but the deer may not. It's true. In fact, that is true, which is one of the big controversies in the spotted owl controversy. We're going to talk about that Friday night, I guess. There's a forum going to be held on spotted owl controversy. Okay. This is a young lodgepole pine forest in what's called the first stage of succession. These are trees that are about 30 to 50 feet tall, and this is somewhere around 100 years of age. This is a forest at about 100 years old. In the second stage, we have some mature lodgepole pine, but underneath it, Sitka, Engelmann spruce, and some western hemlock begin to grow up, and those are the evergreens that have branches all the way down to the bottom. See about the self-pruning we talked about before, how a lodgepole has no branches on its stem whatsoever. They begin to grow up to shade out the lodgepole. Here's an example again of that mosaic. The tree on the left, while it doesn't look like it, is actually a Douglas fir. And it survived. Old Douglas fir tend to survive forest fires fairly well if there's no fuel load underneath them that's going to carry the fire up into the canopy. And that one seemed to be singed a little bit on one side, but it survived the fire fairly well. They have very thick bark, which prevents the fire from damaging the stem of the tree. Here's an example of what we were talking about with aspen. These are aspen suckers. These guys are Forest Service people studying the aspen suckers in June of 1989. So this is less than a year after the fires ended. And you can see the number of new trees growing there. This is an example of maintenance of a meadow. This is one of the meadows in Yellowstone. If you've been on a tour of Yellowstone, you know that one of the beauties of Yellowstone are the many meadows that are just cover the area. And this may look like the landscape of the moon, but this is really a beautiful sight, ecologically speaking, for that meadow, because that meadow now will continue to exist. Had that fire not occurred, those trees that you see creeping in there would have soon taken over that meadow, and that meadow would be gone. This is a special kind of fire called a sedge fire, in which the fire actually gets down in a mat of underground stems that the sedge put out and underground roots that they put out, and it actually burns beneath the ground. This also occurs in peat bogs. Any of you from Indiana know about the South Bend peat fire going on down there? Have you heard about that? I know that's been burning for a couple of years now near South Bend, and peat is a moss, you know that, and it dies out and leaves these fuel loads in the soil. The people in the north, the Finns and Norwegians and the Canadians, harvest peat and use it as fuel in their fireplaces. But when those fires start on the ground, there's no way you can fight them. Because basically peat bogs are swampy areas, so you can't get trucks in there. And they just burn for years and years and years. Sedge fires are similar, although they don't last quite as long. Here's a guy in the fly fishing in the Firehole River, and you can see the whole countryside burned up. One of the big fears was that this fire would cause so much erosion to occur that the streams in Yellowstone would be clouded with sediment for years to come. The fish life would die off as a result. Fortunately, the snow melt the following spring was very slow. It was a cold winter, and it took a long time for the snow to come off, so erosion was held to a minimum. And by the time the end of summer came, those areas that were covered by fire had been regrown with grasses and annual plants, so it held the soil in place, and so erosion never really occurred significantly. In addition, what erosion did occur did two things. The fire did two things to these streams. One is it increased the nutrient load in the streams so that there were actually more nutrients for aquatic insects to eat. More aquatic insects meant more fish, so the fish habitat was improved that way. And secondly, if you've ever stood in the Firehole River above the geysers or in the Madison River in Yellowstone, you know that the temperature of that water is frigid, which is not conducive to fish growth. And when the fires knock down the canopy near the stream bed, they allow the temperature to increase in the water and actually improve fish habitat. Yellowstone Lake itself, which is one of the largest freshwater lakes in America, significantly increased its nutrient load as a result of the fires in 88. And the fishing in Yellowstone Lake is predicted to be the best it has been in the last 300 years for the next 30 years. So if you're going to go fishing in Yellowstone Lake, do it in the next 30 years. Well, we'll go through a couple more of these. Fortunately, what happened, one of the things that happened was that as a result of the fires, many of the native animals to Yellowstone were forced out of Yellowstone during the winter of 88-89 to get their food. Among those were bison and elk that migrated into the territory surrounding Yellowstone. And the state of Montana okayed a special permit hunt for bison. They shot, they shot 500 bison. The prior year, they allowed 39 permits. And the year of the after the fire, they allowed 500 permits. Because they were afraid the bison were going to carry brucellosis, which is a contagious disease, into the cattle herds of the people surrounding Yellowstone Park. In addition, they allowed 2,000 elk to be culled. And some people really got up in arms about this. The reason they allowed this to occur was because in both cases, what is called the carrying capacity of the land had been surpassed by both bison and elk. There were more bison and more elk than could have survived. The reason so many of them survived was that the prior six winters were very mild. Under normal circumstances, the weak of the elk and the bison are culled by the severe winters. But the mildness allowed the populations to build up to artificially high levels. So even though 2,000 elk were allowed to be shot, 30,000 elk remain. So the herd is not in danger because of that. Those are the bison. And then that's an elk. And one last slide. The most significant damage to Yellowstone, interestingly enough, was not caused by fire. It was caused by firefighters. Burned forest, we said the burned forest will return to the state you indicated in 150 years. Burned forest will return to some natural state within a relatively short period of time. But a fire line made by a bulldozer in a forest will not return to its natural state for as long as 500 to 700 years. And depending on the conditions, may never return to its original state. So the decision was made early in the fire not to send bulldozers into the wilderness areas. So one of the problems with fighting the fire, of course, was that the entire wilderness aspect of the fire was fought by hand and by airplane bombers that dropped retardant and water. No bulldozers could make fire lines. Okay. We need to end right now because the time has run over. And I appreciate your attendance. We will be talking again about ecological issues tomorrow at 2 o'clock. We're going to be taking another nature walk. We hope it's not quite as hot as it is today, but we'd stay in the shade. So at that time, any questions you have about this, we'll try to answer. Thank you for coming. Yeah.